So I get some of the most heartfelt letters filled with gratitude from the families. Is it okay? From the families of people who have died. I'm not a mortician. I know I'm wearing all black. I'm a critical care physician. And I meet people and their families on the absolute worst days of their life. Oftentimes, people come into the ICU, and we have no idea if they're going to live or if they're going to die, what recovery is going to look like, if recovery is going to happen. And oftentimes, even when people have advanced directives, when they have been crystal clear on what their wishes are, if and when they reach the end of life, there's always struggle. There's always turmoil with families. There's always the what if. There's always the concept of what if a miracle happens. And most of the advanced directives that I see every day are very actually vague, because they talk about persistent vegetative states and they talk about a terminal condition, and very, very few people actually fit into that category. We also get a lot of drama. We also get Jerry Springer-like family dynamics that start to happen. We get cousins, we get people out of the woodworks, we get spouses, we get girlfriends and boyfriends of people who are married that show up, and we have to navigate all of that with the family. But once we are able to focus back on the patient, this is really when the agony and the anguish and the pain really starts for families. And that's because they now have to get into their loved one's mind and figure out, to the best of their ability, what would their loved one want in this situation. And they have to go to their personal beliefs, their spiritual beliefs, their religious beliefs, and try to figure out what would you do, what would they say if they were sitting at the table and able to participate in our conversation. And I always thought, I don't understand why this happens. Until I experienced it probably 10 or 12 years into practice, when my father, who was a scientist, who was crystal clear on what his wishes were, because he knew he had a chronic disease with a progressive decline, and he was now reaching the end of his life. And he told me, I never, ever want to be your patient. I don't want artificial means to prolong my life. And when the time comes, I go on my terms, comfortable and dignified. And yet, when the day did come, and intellectually I knew the day was coming, when I got that call, you know, I was frightened, I was nervous, I was nauseous. I felt like the weight of the world was sitting on my back. And he had crystal clear advanced directives that he wrote to me, not on a pre-made form, but on those old yellow legal pads with this bright blue ink. And he's told me, he told his brothers and his sisters, and still my oldest uncle said, well, let's give him a chance. Let's put him on a ventilator for a few days. What if a miracle happens? And I had to respectfully disagree strongly and be my father's advocate with my uncle. And I had to tell him, if a miracle was going to be granted, don't you think it would have been granted to maybe cure this disease that had no cure that he had? We have to honor him. And 36 hours later, he was with God. So I go back to doing things your way. And the complicated relationships don't end with families. They're just as complicated between doctors and their patients. About 5 or 6 years ago or so, I was taking care of a woman who had had a 20-year history with breast cancer. The first treatment, she did super. About 13 years later, she had a recurrence. She's still with the same oncologist. She's treated, she does quite well. But now the third recurrence that happens, it comes back and it's aggressive and it's metastatic and it's filled her lungs. And she ends up being my patient in the ICU because she needed support with breathing. We were able to get her off the ventilator. And during this time, I called her oncologist who I've known for a long time. I've worked with him. And this is one of these people who's really moves fast, talks fast, you know, very full of life. And when I called him, and I'll call her Mary, and I told him, you know, and I'll call him Bob, Mary's in the ICU. What are our options for her? And this very gregarious man was suddenly silent. Long pauses. And I didn't know what that was all about. And then his voice started to crack. And he said to me, there's nothing else I can offer her. Her disease is far gone. And he said, but I can't face her. I can't tell her that. We've been through hell and back together for 20 years. And I can't tell her this. So I told him, okay, well, I have to tell her this. She has to know. I went into her room. And this woman is fire. She's just pure fire. She sits up in the bed. She starts adjusting her hospital gown. But when I shut the door behind me, she suddenly started to glare at me. And I told her, I talked to Bob, and he said there are no more options. There are no protocols at the NIH that you would, you know, be a candidate for. And we need to really start talking about your wishes and your comfort and what the end may or may not look like, even though we don't know a timeline. And she took a big sigh and she said to me, thank God, because I was done. But I couldn't tell him that. Because we've been together for 20 years. He's been through hell and back with me. And she didn't feel that she could let him down. And I was like, I think you two need like a room or something. Like, you know, and I said, so, well, I'll call him. I'll call him back because he actually can't even bring himself to come to see you. He can't face you. So I called him and I told him what happened. He goes, great, then I'm going to come and visit her, but I am no longer her oncologist. I'm coming as a friend. And somebody else has to do this because I just can't. And what we do know is that the longer you have a relationship with your patient, the harder it is for you to go down that path when it's time to go down that path. And we struggle too. But still, I'm still an outsider looking in, even though I've experienced the end of life with my parent. And it wasn't until I got catastrophically sick, when I was about 2 months away from my 46th birthday. And it was one of those, it doesn't matter what the disease is or was. And it wasn't until, you know, I had to think about the possibility of outcomes. And I could either fully recover and do well. There was an option of I could have varying degrees of disability depending on if complications of this process decided to rear their ugly head. And death was also a very real possibility. And I remember at that instant, although I was very sick, there was still an element of clarity in my brain. And I was never more clear in my life than at that moment as to what I would want to happen if I went down the path of severe disability or death, or inevitable death. And my husband was sitting in the hospital room with me the day I got admitted. And I couldn't tell him. I knew exactly what I wanted to say, but I couldn't face him. I couldn't tell him that if X, Y, or Z happens, these are my wishes. And at this point, I want no more aggressive intervention, and it's time to go. So I waited until he went home to get my personal belongings to bring back to the hospital because this admission was unexpected. It was sudden. And I remembered that afternoon as he was still there before he went home. You know, my vision started to become blurred. The right side, I started to not see from the right side. My gait started to become off. I had the worst headache of my life. And I knew that this is my window of time to say and write, actually write it, what I needed to share so that it's memorialized and my crazy family doesn't accuse him of making things up. So I get my phone out. My thumbs were working fine, but my handwriting had started to become pretty poor. And I'd send him an email saying the things I needed to say to him, the things I needed to tell him about our son, what to do if I'm not here, and most importantly, what my wishes are if the end is near or if this doesn't work out. He came back 90 minutes later, And he blew into the room, and he was mad, he was sad, he was crying. He thought that my peers and I knew something that we weren't sharing with him. We were lying to him about what was going on with me. He's a non-medical person. And I told him, you have to honor my wishes. And he said, I'm not talking about it. I'm not talking about this. I'm not hearing any of this. We never talked about it again and luckily, I am beyond fortunate, and I realize this every day, that I was just blessed to go down the path of complete and total recovery. And now I can look back at that horrible year and a half, and count my blessings. But the experience of being a physician who does, and I was able to go back to work full time and live my life again. But what it taught me from the perspective of doing this for probably now, it was about 15 years before I had my own personal experience, doing it with patients and families, my father, and then having to actually think about my own mortality, maybe, in a very raw and real sense, changed the way I practice, changed the way I approach my patients and their families, realized that you can't have one discussion, it's conversations, and that the value of establishing what means most to you, what aligns with your core values, what aligns with your personal beliefs, how you want to live your life and or die, can only be done on your terms if you are clear, explicit, you write it out, it's unique to you, and not only do you write it out, but you actually talk to the people you love and the people who would be the people at the table, if and when that time comes. So thank you.